It's time for another installment of Josh's Library Corner. Today, he's discussing the new Book Talk viral suspense thriller, Ask for Andrea, by Noelle W. Eiley. So, Josh, what did you think of Ask for Andrea?
I loved it. I just finished reading it this morning. It's the story of three women who are all murdered by the same man that they meet on a dating app. They all are murdered and wake up as spirits. They exist among the living, but they can't really do anything to communicate with them other than very slightly. But it's a story about how the three of them separately, and then they come together as the story goes on, try to solve their own murders.
Ooh.
And try to get the murderer arrested, caught for it.
That sounds fascinating.
Yeah, it was great. It's unique to see that conflict and struggle to try to affect something that's essentially impossible because they're dead and everyone else is alive. To see them figure out how to do that is really one of the coolest parts of the book. I was really satisfied with the conclusion. It was emotional, touching throughout. It was exciting, suspenseful. The emotions were real, even though the story is about the supernatural.
Thank you, Josh, for sharing your newest read from your library corner called Ask for Andrea. And as of October 28th, you can find the deluxe special edition trade paperback of Ask for Andrea with these gorgeous book edges wherever books are sold, but only for a limited time. While picking up your copy of Ask for Andrea at Books A Million, bookshop.org, or Thrift Books, or your favorite bookstore, check out the five other thriller suspense novels by author Noelle W. Eiley.
What it reads on the edge of the book is, "Dead Women Don't Forget."
Ooh.
It's a cool paperback.
You see Kristen in her braces, and I know during that time was when she was seeing that teacher, and there was a picture of her in braces. I'm like, oh my gosh, she was just a baby. That man was just anyway, how he changed the trajectory of her life, you have to wonder.
Oh gosh, for sure. Absolutely, Teresa.
Yeah, would she have moved to Virginia City? I'm sure she would have visited because her mom was there every once in a while, but would she have moved down there and found these bad actors, and, you know, would her life have ended up, or, you know, her path ended as whatever it has?
When I received an email from Teresa Letcher about her missing friend, I was surprised I hadn't heard of the case. Not because I'm so well-versed, I'm often introduced to cases I've never heard of. I was surprised to not know of the disappearance of Kristen Tomlin, Teresa's childhood friend, because the case is so bizarre, intriguing, and scandalous. Over the next two episodes, I'll be discussing Kristen Tomlin's life growing up in the Portland area and the upsetting string of events that led to her eventually boarding the Freedom 2 yacht, the last place she would be seen alive. I'll also be joined by Kristen's high school friends, Teresa and Rhonda, to discuss their friendship with Kristen and why Teresa decided to write the book about her disappearance, Kristen, Can You Hear Me? In case anyone has a funky brain like I do, just be prepared going into this that there are not only a lot of characters, but a lot of aliases for many of them. So you're going to hear a lot of names, and I'm just going to try my darndest to keep everything straight for you. It's Teresa's opinion that because of those aliases and the strange criminal circumstances surrounding Kristen's disappearance, her part of the story has been lost to time and the sea, just as she was. I will be telling you about the characters involved in the story, but the focus isn't on them. It's about Kristen, who seemed to be an innocent party caught up with the wrong people. To understand why Kristen was in the company of known criminals, or why she was willing to get on their boat, you have to go back, way back, to when she was in middle school. Because Kristen's case has received such little attention, there is little information available. So for her backstory, I'm relying heavily on the information provided by Teresa in her book and via an interview with her and another friend of Kristen, Rhonda.
Yeah, hi, I'm Teresa Letcher, and I remember Kristen far back in like maybe sixth grade in grade school. We weren't close friends yet until about eighth grade when Rhonda joined us, and then the three of us got together. And we were friends throughout grade school and high school and afterwards. Visited her in Virginia City when she took the move down there. Corresponded with her and visited her when she would come home for her short visits. You know, we were kind of the friends that were left when she disappeared. It's been frustrating set of decades that really nothing's happened with her story. So that's why I decided to write the book. I retired and had the time. I'm not a writer, but it's just so frustrating when somebody that you know and care about goes missing. There's just this void and this kind of persistent wonder and grief, and it just leads to a lifelong frustration about the case.
Well, my name's Rhonda Ann Vogel. I met Kristen in the eighth grade, and the same time I met Teresa. Basically, Teresa was in my classroom, and I met Kristen on my way to school, and we became friends, all three of us, basically, eighth grade through high school. I ended up marrying her stepbrother. So I kind of knew her extended family. I knew her mother, Alice. I knew all of her brothers. I mean, I knew her dad. I lived in their childhood home. So that's sort of how I knew her. In fact, Teresa and I were waiting for her to come back for my birth of my second child, who was due on around November. And so he was born on November 28th. So obviously that I was pretty upset with her when she called me the last time I talked to her and basically said, I'm, you know, not coming back and I can't really tell you why. And so when I heard that, I just sort of was mad and didn't really pay attention. And I wish I would have. And that was the last time I talked to her on a phone. I just never heard again. So, yeah.
The biggest reason Teresa wanted to speak with us is to get the word out about Kristen, because the lack of coverage for how wild this story is shocking.
Same here. Good golly. That's like one of my biggest frustrations, is that I just always hope that somebody would investigate just Kristen.
Kristen was not only the baby of four children, she was the only girl and very much played into those roles. She was a daddy's girl, so she and her brothers stayed with their father in Southeast Portland when their parents divorced after 14 years of marriage. The marriage didn't work because Kristen's mom was a bohemian, free spirit. Her father was formal, more serious. Their desires and expectations of home and social life were just too different. Although Dad wasn't too formal, he did use a retired hearse as the family car, mostly because his size made it tricky to find a comfortable vehicle. Kristen and the boys did spend time with their mother, who had moved to Lincoln City, which is at the Oregon coast. It was exciting for Kristen when she got to see her mom. Her life was so different than how her father lived. She was social, always out with friends. There was a sense of freedom that Kristen was intrigued by. In 1972, not long after the divorce, Kristen's dad remarried a woman with four kids of her own, making them an extended Brady Bunch. As a young student, Kristen was smart, artistic, kind, clever, a good friend. She had good grades and kept to herself. She wasn't really shy, just not outspoken. She really thrived while participating in outdoor school in sixth grade. She also loved to journal, and in her outdoor school diary, she wrote, "This place is so peaceful and calm. As I write, the air is still, yet violently fresh and invigorating." Sixth grade writing like that.
Violently fresh.
I know, right?
Wow.
Along with journaling, Kristen loved to write stories and poetry. Called the Kid by her family members, Kristen grew up and started to learn more about herself. She loved swim class, hated dance. Her stepmom struggled to understand Kristen's tomboy nature and wanted to bring out her femininity. She did so by forcing her to take finishing classes. The kid hated those, too. Outside of the unpleasant classes and judgments from her stepmom, the new home life was good, peaceful. When not put in classes, Kristen's stepmom would talk to her about her masculine clothing, her bad attitude, and lack of hygiene. She also made Dad turn in the hearse for a Cadillac convertible, a downgrade if you ask me. Because it was the 70s and her parents were divorced and dealing with eight children, Kristen was unattended more and more, and she started drinking in eighth grade. Not excessively, with friends and such, but still, that's pretty young. At the same time, she started to develop a crush on a teacher at school. He wasn't her teacher, but she was across the hall from him. From there, she would watch as he pulled rowdy students from the room and physically roughed them up in the hall. Perhaps in her youthful confusion, she was seeking advice from her father and stepmother, which could explain why she told them one night over dinner that she had a crush, and it was on her teacher. Her parents kind of dismissed it, explained that she was just infatuated and it would pass. If they had known where this proclivity was headed, perhaps they would have talked to her more about how a student shouldn't feel that way toward a teacher. She took their advice, and eventually she was pretty much over that guy. In 1976, Kristen prepared to attend Cleveland High School on Southeast 26th in Portland. She remained a quiet student, but she was excited for her future, looking forward to focusing on psychology, and she continued to get great grades. Her success as a student led to her being invited to work as one of the teacher's assistants. As high school started without issue, Kristen's home life became more difficult. Unlike most situations where we hear of a child being neglected or ignored, Kristen was suffering from an opposite fate. With her older siblings grown and off to school and step-siblings only there for visits, she was left at home with her parents, becoming the focus of their love and attention, which she was not fond of. She was also not a fan of the expectations put on her. Like, if she wanted to go to a friend's house, she could, but she would have to complete some chores first. And we're not talking about your average take-out-the-trash chores. We're talking about degrading chores, like cleaning out her father's smoking pipe, rubbing his neck, or trimming his toenails. Acts that conflicted with their praise of her honor student status.
No one should have to look at dad's feet.
No, but a child in this weird Cinderella setup of, okay, you can go and you're a great student and you don't really get in trouble. But first, very weird. As far as the book goes, that's really the only element of that. So it's not like it continued and they were so controlling or abusive or anything like that. That's kind of the only example of this weird boundary issue they have, which I also find interesting because normally something like that is the starting point. Already having an eye for teachers and perhaps older men in general, which might be thanks to dad's weird boundaries, Kristen sought solace by spending more and more time with the teacher that she was an assistant to. In the book, he is referred to as Mr. Doe. A quick note about this teacher before we move forward. I do have his actual name, but because he has not been named in the book or by police, I am not going to be using his name here. And I want to say thank you to our friend Haley Gray with True Crime Research Training. I wasn't sure how to handle this situation, and she really helped me out a lot, as she has before. So on that note, I also did not reach out to the teacher's children because I didn't want to upset them, and I'm not providing his name for that same reason. I do want to give a little bit of background for the foundation of the story, and just so you have an understanding of the power dynamic that was involved. Through the early 1960s, Teacher Doe was a celebrated and award-winning athlete, even ending up in multiple halls of fame. As an adult, he became an educator. During that time, he taught art and coached multiple sports. From what I can tell, it seems he was just a sports-centered jock who, I really can only imagine, was probably pretty entitled and arrogant. When I worked in schools, we had what we called the turkey trot, when you had a staff member who maybe hadn't done anything that you could fire them for, but they were problematic. Think abusive clergyman style, then you would shuffle them around to other schools. This usually happened early in the school year, hence the turkey. Seeing as Doe worked at no less than 6 high schools in the Portland and surrounding areas throughout his career, I can't help but wonder if there were concerns that led to him being moved or if that was a choice he made. If you think you might have also been a victim of Doe and you'd like to reach out to us, please feel free to do so at murderintherain@gmail.com. I want to make it very clear that since we cannot speak to Kristen and Teacher Doe passed away in September of 22, these are all allegations and there is no way for us to prove any of the statements about him or his relationship with Kristen.
Because I'm curious why the hell the wife stayed with him and then never did anything. And he never, as far as what we found out, is that he got like this great write-up about what a great freaking retired teacher, you know, and it just makes me so mad.
People know who he was. People know what he did. And I'm sure there are probably some teachers who knew. So that kind of pisses me off as well. But Mr. Doe, he left Cleveland High School right around the time that Kristen went missing. Is that a coincidence? I don't know. It probably is. However, you got to wonder if he was trying to avoid scrutiny because, like I said, there were other students that knew, that know.
And other victims of with this teacher. I mean, another student who was Kristen's age, or maybe a year, I don't know what age difference, and the mother of that student. It's disgusting. And you would think he would be the stud, but he was like disgusting. He was gross.
Kristen wanted to spend as much time as possible with Doe, so she rearranged her schedule to work in his room. One day, after a class, she and Doe were looking over papers when he started to gently rub her back, aka grooming. It's believed Kristen was scared and excited in the moment, but it all stopped as quickly as it had started, and they both ignored that line being crossed. Now that the physical boundary was passed, Doe continued his grooming by complaining about his home life with Kristen. He explained to her that, yes, he was married, but it was a bad marriage and he would be divorcing his wife soon. And that was just Kristen's freshman year. The following year, Kristen was once again working in Doe's classroom and their relationship crossed another line. At one point, Doe grabbed Kristen, confessed his love for her, and kissed her. Neither of them cared that she was only 15 and he was 35. For Kristen, she considered this her first love. And as a young girl who was already older boy crazy, she quickly became consumed by the relationship. The two agreed that, despite his marriage, being a teacher, being an adult, or 20 years her senior, they were going to pursue their feelings. They couldn't go out on dates, so she would stay after class and they would kiss. This escalated into locking the classroom door so they could make out. That escalated into locking the door, turning off the lights, and going into the storage closet to fool around even more. On one occasion, while in the closet, Doe began to undress 15-year-old Kristen. She stopped him, but not because she wasn't interested. She was a young girl, and she didn't want to have her first time be in a classroom storage closet. To convince her otherwise, Doe told her that he loved her. She said she wanted to wait to have sex, and he agreed, fully understanding why she would want to do so. He then proceeded to undress her and rape her. Their relationship was becoming so hot and heavy, since she was an only child and couldn't recognize his control and power imbalance, or that he had technically raped her, and he started to become nervous. It was just too risky to keep up the charade behind classroom doors. If they were caught, he could be fired, divorced, and even arrested. That was okay, though. Doe had a plan. East of school in Gresham, he had a little plot of land which housed his family's camping trailer. There was plenty of room, and it was isolated. So long as the family wasn't using it for vacation, it could be their clandestine headquarters. Now that Kristen was sexually active, she started taking birth control. For anyone who doesn't know, birth control pills are about 99% accurate in preventing pregnancy, but only if they are taken properly, which also means taking them around the same time every single day, a habit that is not the easiest to get into, especially as a teenager. Even though she tried her best, Kristen found herself pregnant with the teacher's baby at 15 years old. She broke the news to Doe, who was upset with her. You know, it was her fault for not taking the pill correctly, not his fault for raping a child. Giving her some money, he paid for her to have an abortion and to get a cab to the clinic and back, by herself. What a great guy. At this point, it seems everything started to take a darker turn for Kristen. She was devastated about the abortion and pregnancy. She certainly hadn't wanted to have a baby at that age, but once she was pregnant, she didn't really want to get an abortion. Finally, through the chaos of her sophomore year, Kristen spent the summer at the beach with her mother and brothers. Before she left, Doe promised Kristen that this summer would be the one where he broke the news to his wife and children about getting a divorce. Fun little side fact about Kristen's mom. By this time, she had joined the Lincoln City Clowns, which is a group that participated in and provided entertainment for local events. This rolled over into a collection of clown figurines, which started to fill her home. Kristen was fond of all of this, especially the whimsy it brought into her mother's life. It was like a bright, silly world, contrary to the dark and complicated one she had waiting for her at home. For the rest of the summer, she lived a regular teenager's life. She attended soccer games, went to Oaks Park, a local amusement park here. Then it was time to get back to school and start her junior year. Once again, Kristen was Doe's TA. Contrary to his promises, he had not broken the news to his family over the summer, but he promised it would be happening soon. Despite the distraction of her predatory teacher, Kristen continued to receive straight A's. During a weekend when Doe's family was out of town, he invited Kristen to spend it with him at his home. She was hoping he would tell her the divorce was coming, but he didn't. Instead, he played house, showing her around the home that he claimed they would be living in once he was free of his wife. Kristen felt this new life would be taking place any day now, so she took the brave step of confessing to her parents of her years-long affair. She wanted her parents to have time to get comfortable with the idea of seeing the two of them together. Because of Kristen's crush on her teacher in middle school, her parents weren't totally shocked by her admission. In fact, they kind of didn't react at all. They didn't call the school or the police. They didn't tell her that it was rape or statutory rape. They told her they weren't really fond of the large age gap and that she needed to be careful messing with a married man. 'Cause that's the 70s for you, baby.
Thanks, guys, I guess.
Good job, parents.
I guess I'll go back to my affair with my teacher.
Much older married teacher. Yeah. To understand what was going on a little better, Kristen's father then called Doe to ask him what was going on. Doe, of course, lied and said Kristen was just making it all up. Poor girl. Her parents believed this piece of shit over their child, so they sent her to a therapist. Because of how everything played out, she decided then and there that she would no longer be telling her parents any personal information. In her case, honesty equaled treatment. Being taught that being secretive was better, Kristen told her parents that, oh, yeah, she made up the relationship, nothing to worry about there, and they believed her. As Kristen tried to manage her life and lies without the support of her family, another shift came that started to alter everything. One day when Kristen went to Doe's classroom, she caught him in an act that might have given her deja vu. She peered in and saw that he was rubbing the back of his newer, younger freshman TA. Overall, junior year was calmer than sophomore, but it was still chaotic. In the summer before her senior year, Kristen took her first trip to Virginia City, Nevada. She went there because her mother had started going there for work.
What city was that?
Virginia City. It's not far outside of Reno.
You know, Nevada. It's a good place when it's the name of another place.
Yes.
In a different state.
Yes. It's not really known if her mom had moved to Virginia City full time or maybe just snowbirding, but her life there was an enviable one for Kristen. She watched as her mother socialized with everyone in the city, kept a chaotic and busy social schedule, and just seemed to be thriving. For the first time in her life, Kristen felt she belonged somewhere. Kristen returned home to Portland and started her final high school year, excited to be part of the class of 1979. Kristen was still engaging in a relationship with Doe even after the freshman TA incident. He continued to promise a divorce was imminent. By the end of 1978, he would tell her. Well, that came and went without a breakup. Kristen started to shift her focus from Doe to her own future. The therapy she had been forced to participate in had inspired her, and she became interested in psychology, social work, and philosophy. And even with all of that going on in her life, she remained on the honor roll.
That's an unbelievable amount of stress for a person to have to go through, even someone who's been alive for a lot longer than that.
Yes.
It's unimaginable.
Yeah, to not have your family.
And just such an incredibly complex situation that you're in, and dangerous.
Very. Naivete, maybe, that she didn't realize how serious it was.
Well, yeah, I think you just don't have any sort of perspective.
Yeah, you're like, oh, he likes me, and this is fun, and we get to do these adult things, not really able to see how big that picture is.
Yeah, even a step further than they are right there.
Yeah.
She can't see that.
And she still had straight A's.
That too. That's, I mean, I meant that as well. That's
I'm like, I had nothing going on and I'm like, I passed a class, baby.
Yeah, I was straight, super low C's, barely made it out of there. I still have nightmares about not graduating high school. I had some stuff going on, but nah.
Everything changed with a ring of Kristen's phone one evening. On the other end was Mrs. Doe. She confessed to having followed her husband, and that was how she caught Kristen going to the trailer with him. The trailer that, by the way, was never actually used for family camping adventures. Doe had purchased it strictly as his secret sex hideout. She was as shocked to learn about Kristen as Kristen was to hear about the trailer. Mrs. Doe went on, rubbing salt in the wound by saying that Connie, the new freshman Kristen had seen getting the special back rub from Mr. Doe, was his newest trailer girl. Doe had never asked for or even brought up a divorce. He was simply a known philanderer and predator, and for some reason, the missus tolerated it and did not turn him in.
That's one of the worst kinds of people. Anyone who's associated with someone who does things like that and does nothing about it.
She called a 17-year-old child at home to berate her for what she was doing.
Yeah, she does nothing positive with it or something that will have
just to devastate this child.
Yeah. Well, think how miserable she is.
Oh, yeah. Doesn't call the police, doesn't call the school, doesn't confront him, doesn't show up at the trailer.
And are we in on the coast?
No, this is in Portland.
Okay.
But the trailer is out in Gresham. Kristen did have concerns ever since Connie came into the picture and how Doe dragged on their being together. This confirmed everything. She was not only heartbroken, but to make things unimaginably worse for the high schooler, she learned she was once again pregnant with Doe's baby. The second abortion came with a more painful recovery, but she came through it all right. Amazingly, no one in her family knew of any of the struggles she was going through. Because she was so young and had been groomed by Doe, Kristen couldn't pull herself away from him. Even after that phone call from his wife, she went on about her business as if she had never been told any of it. She couldn't bring herself to let go of her secret and first love. It seemed like everything in Kristen's life was telling her to make a change. Her boyfriend was never going to be with her, and he was actively cheating. She had gone through two abortions alone, her parents were smothering her, and she didn't know what direction her life post-high school would go. Spring break came around, and with just a few weeks left in school, Kristen took the opportunity to once again visit her mother in Virginia City. Taking a bus to Reno, Kristen arrived and found her mom tending bar. Again, they had a great time, and Kristen felt even more at home there. When spring break came to an end, Kristen was back in school, but she stopped staying behind in Doe's classroom. However, she did still have visits with him at the trailer. Finally, that June, Kristen graduated from high school. She craved the freedom her mother seemed to have with her life, so she figured the best way to go about escaping was to go to Virginia City, which she did in July of 1979. It may seem strange to anyone who hasn't been in a relationship with an inappropriate power dynamic or abuse, but leaving Doe was the hardest part for Kristen, and she hated that she felt anything for him.
Because Kristen had had the falling out already through the teacher's wife calling, that I think that was just like, oh, hey, what the hell? What do I've got to lose? Like, I might as well go here too. And so it was just sort of really that kind of a happening. I don't think it was very much more than that. Her mom called after that and said, this is where I'm going to be. And do you want to go help? And why not? And that's, yeah, I think it was out of the blue.
If you've ever visited our blog at murderintherain.com, you have seen that most of our sources come from newspapers.com.
Extra, extra. To get started on your own newspapers.com journey, go to newspapers.com/crime. Use discount code MURDERINTHERAIN to get 20% off.
We here at Murder in the Rain are so excited, elated, overjoyed to say that we are sponsored by newspapers.com, our favorite website.
And as close to the microfiche as we'll ever be.
My favorite part. I've had a dream my whole life of being a little Harriet the Spy and going to the library and getting the microfiche and spinning that dial. Oh, finding this article. That dream has come true because that's basically what newspapers.com is.
Much easier to read than microfiche.
That's true. So newspapers for the win.
Yes. Nothing compares to you, newspapers.
That's right.
Nothing compares to you.
To get started on your own newspapers.com journey, go to newspapers.com/crime. When you sign up, use discount code MURDERINTHERAIN to get 20% off. We dare you to sign up, look up a date, a location, a famous crime, or a person, and just try to not spiral for the rest of the day. That's newspapers.com/crime using discount code MURDERINTHERAIN. Built in 1862, the Old Washoe Club in Virginia City is known as the most haunted place in the most haunted city. Ooh. Maybe Kristen, having been born on a Friday the 13th, was drawn to the spooky location. Old Washoe Club has been featured on all sorts of ghost shows, but if you can believe this, I was unable to find any actual stories about any murders that took place at the club. Not that they didn't happen, maybe things weren't reported, but to find nothing...
You were in the newspaper archives for that?
I certainly was.
Not a murder.
And that's the whole backstory of the ghost. There's one specific ghost that was a sex worker who was murdered there, and she haunts it still. I couldn't find anything about any murders, but it gives some real Jeremiah Lexer vibes, if you know what I mean, Josh.
I do.
Some of our listeners from a couple Halloweens ago might remember. The three-story black building that houses the club is in the heart of Virginia City's main thoroughfare. As of now, the ground level is commercial, while the two upper levels have been businesses, unoccupied, and when Kristen lived there, apartments. This made for an ideal commute as she worked in a cafe downstairs. And I've never been to Virginia City, but from everything I saw, maybe more people have been to Old Town Sacramento. It appears to have that kind of same look with the old wooden sidewalks and saloons and that Old West vibe.
Tumbleweeds?
Probably. It's Virginia City.
Well, look out. Those can damage you if they hit your car.
When her first summer came to an end, she wrote home, talking about how happy she was, enjoying work, the tourists, and even the famous camel races. The what, you ask? Why, the famous Virginia City camel and ostrich races that celebrated their 66th event this last September. From visitvirginiacitynv.com, watch as camels, ostriches, and even zebras gather in Virginia City to carry daring riders across the finish line in this family-friendly, must-see event. One of Nevada's most iconic events started because of a prank war between Virginia City's Territorial Enterprise and the San Francisco Chronicle. In 1959, the editor of the Enterprise wrote a fake story about camels racing in Virginia City. The Chronicle didn't realize it was a hoax and printed it. The following year, they borrowed camels from the San Francisco Zoo and took them to Virginia City to race them. And that is how a tradition was born. So there you go. If you're in Virginia City in the summer, you can catch events like Hot Camel Nights or Saturday's Camel Hump to C Street.
I don't like that one. Hot Camel Nights.
I can picture Joe Camel on that poster.
That's all I can see is that big old nose of his.
That's the famous tourist trap of Virginia City.
I feel like someone's definitely raising camels out in that way.
At that point now, 60 years later,
we have
I'm
to
sure.
just have a camel supply.
We can't keep borrowing from the zoo. Even if I have my own feelings about the ghostly history of the place, Kristen actually lived there and had her own experiences, including times she was alone and when friends were visiting. Ghosts didn't keep Kristen from thriving in her new environment. She finally felt independent and was even carving a path to happiness. Her newfound joy allowed her to revisit old hobbies like writing poetry and journals, playing music, and she was all about self-care. From the book, Kristen, Can You Hear Me? On June 5th, 1980, she wrote a letter to a friend which read, "About a week after I got here, I got my own room back at the Old Washoe Club. Quite a change for the kid. I woke up one morning and sort of found myself living alone, hundreds of miles from home, working, paying my own way, and wondering, what am I doing? I wouldn't exactly say I am happy, yet I am not unhappy like days before. I'm loving the hell out of living alone. I don't have to account for myself to anybody. Other than work, my schedule is mine, and I love it." Kristen was making decent money, but it had to hold her over through the cold no-tourist season when things got cold, lonely, and isolated. 6 months after moving south, Kristen returned to Portland to ring in not just the new year, but a new decade. New Year's Day, 1980, Kristen couldn't stop herself, and she called Doe to wish him a happy new year. He had the nerve to say that he missed and still loved her. He still had his claws in her, so Kristen agreed to meet up for a trailer rendezvous. Things were a bit different this time, as she was armed with the knowledge of not being his only lover, so she had a newfound fear of STIs. To protect herself, she asked him to wear a condom. He didn't say no, didn't argue about protection or why she would want it. Instead, he, the teacher with a secret sex with teens trailer, happily popped open a drawer and pulled out one of the many condoms he had stored in there. In a way, it was good for Kristen to see Doe again. He made her stomach churn. She wasn't blinded by love or butterflies. She was pretty much over it. Something someone else wasn't over was Kristen's stepmom about nagging. She couldn't just enjoy the visit with Kristen. She had to get on her about how tomboy she was. It was grating for Kristen and reminded her why she moved away. Kristen went back to VC but wasn't gone very long, returning in March for a friend's wedding. Her addiction to Doe led to her calling him again. He lied about the divorce and somehow convinced her to meet at the trailer. This time, though, there were no more pity conversations about the future, nothing humoring her about a divorce, just a hookup. She wouldn't be gone long from Portland after that trip. Rhonda, whose wedding she attended, was expecting a baby, and Kristen made plans for an extended trip home to help. She wouldn't be as helpful as she had hoped, as she had to delay her arrival after taking a fall and breaking her ankle. Her final trip home would be spent on crutches. Even at 18 and now living on her own nearly 500 miles away, her family was still strict about her schedule and curfew. She still had to get permission to go out, was asked questions about her plans. Amazingly, that wasn't the straw that broke the racing camel's back. One night, while Kristen was home in her bedroom sleeping, one of her brothers was also home visiting and had friends staying with him. They had all been drinking and partying when one of those friends wandered into Kristen's room in the middle of the night and groped her. She didn't hesitate to fight him off by splitting his face open with an alarm clock. Hell yeah, Kristen. The commotion caused the family to wake, and Kristen expected her father to come storming in, kick the guy's ass, and send him home. Dad started by having the guy go back to his son's room, where he had a little chat with him. Dad returned to Kristen and told her, "The guy apologized, so he doesn't need to leave." She responded by yelling, "Well, he didn't apologize to me." Her dad comforted her by saying that the guy didn't mean anything by it. He kissed her head and told her to go to sleep. Kristen was so disgusted by her father's actions, well, lack thereof, she decided then and there that she would never go back. She didn't need him to not protect her, her stepmother to harass her, or Doe to continually make her miserable. There was nothing for her in Portland. So to tie up the loose ends, she called Doe and arranged a meetup. On her terms, they had sex one last time, even though the thought of him made her sick, and she dumped him. Continuing to be a badass, she didn't bother getting a ride home from him. She straight up crutched away 2 miles to the closest bus stop. With each hobble, she left Doe behind her, looking forward to her new life.
Her parents' treatment of her, and specifically her father, makes it make a little more sense that it would happen this way with the teacher.
Yes, the attention.
Yeah.
Yeah, that it was positive attention and...
Yeah, probably the only seemingly positive interactions with an adult male. Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know enough about her family. That would be something for Teresa to speak on. But almost a form of neglect abuse where it's you just weren't there. And anytime she's trying to utilize you as a parent, it's dismissed or ignored or no. Let's not get upset. Don't rock the boat now. After that interaction, Kristen decided it was time to go back to her new home, Virginia City. She kind of Irish goodbye'd her friends and promised that she'd be back soon. They hated that she was leaving on what seemed like a sour note, so they offered her a new life, but in Portland. Her friends worked together, trying to offer her an apartment and a job interview. She loved and appreciated all of the support, but she didn't feel that she had enough time away from Doe to really heal and to stave off her addiction. In a letter to her friends after that abrupt exit, she said, "Well, that hopeless case on crutches is back on top again. I'm so happy to be here again and out of that house. I'm working, living alone, partying, writing, looking at the scenery, and smiling again. I love it. I love it. I love it. I can imagine how weird it must have been to be with you now that I'm away and feel so relaxed and content again. Thank you and Carol for putting up with me. Portland just isn't my space. Not today. I fell in lust with a single man a week ago, and that has added spice to my life, too. Nothing real serious, which is nice to enjoy myself without heartaches and bullshit. Not longing anything or anyone feels great."
How old is Kristen at this time?
At this time, she's about 18, 19. It's a real shame the mystery of the man she was seeing wasn't named in the letter. It would have answered a lot of questions about what happened to Kristen.
I thought she was happy personally.
Yeah, I felt like she enjoyed and needed the independence. And I felt like that made her stronger and made her feel stronger. You know, and at that age, that's what we all started doing. So that's what I saw when we were there. It was a strange place for me, where we stayed. And
so weird. I wouldn't have stayed there, but yeah, she loved it.
And she was very welcoming to new people, and she loved new people. And she would always say, "You're good people. He's good people. She's good people." Hey, down to earth and those kinds of things. So
she trusted way too much.
Yes, she did. So I think she was meeting people that she really enjoyed, and the independence and just getting away from home and school and him, I think really gave her some strength. So it seemed like a good thing, although I couldn't have stayed.
Probably the worst place she could have ended up.
You know, it had its charm with the wooden sidewalks and the saloons, but it was just a little scary. I was glad when we went home, but you know, we were kids.
Yeah. I think of the story, Teresa, in the letter. This is what makes me think of why Kristen did so well there, is that she was just so proud of any little bit that she accomplished. You know, like if she was able to earn a little bit of money and put a little bit away and then plan for a big spending spree. I mean, she was so simple. Like she really was. It didn't take a whole lot for her to, I think, feel good or whatever. Because when we went there, I mean, Teresa was like, "Where did we sleep?" And I'm like, "I think we slept on the floor." I don't think she had much in there. I remember she had her stereo and a few records, and like, it was very her little coffee pot that I remember she wrote in her letter about her buying, and her, you know, just she was just super, felt super grown up. That's what she kept saying. I feel so grown up.
We did tour around. She had a friend, Rennie, who drove us around to, you know, old silver mines, and we hiked around there and walked through town. It's a touristy kind of place, so there's a lot of things to look at, you know, the old jail and lots of saloons to walk in and poke around. And we did that. And as I mentioned in the book, the sheriff took us to the haunted cemetery, you know, those kinds of things. So through Kristen's kind of this walking tour of the B Street, the main street, just walking around, poking our nose into places, and then other friends taking us around, and then helping her, you know, with her tasks that she was working at the old Washoe. That was pretty much it. Tours with friends and tours with Kristen and kind of hanging around the old Washoe.
Yeah, we were underage to really drink or anything. I mean, we took the Greyhound bus there, like, which was just a whole exciting adventure in itself, you know. And I have mostly memories of just the weird things. Like there was this crazy passenger on the bus, and he kept just running around being weird and being like, "Where's my mom? Where's my mom?" And I was a smart ass, and I'd be like, "Oh, she's out there. She's over there. She was looking for you," and la la la. And then all of a sudden we see him like being tackled by all these cops and shit in this little room. And he was like, "Escape from some insane asylum," you know? And I'm just like clueless. You know, I was just like a crazy person that walked in the saloon in the middle of the night, and we had like no freaking idea, like, why, you know, is this person here? Yeah, it was just all around just very, very interesting.
So in 2 weeks, we'll have the second part of this episode, and I'm going to be discussing the other characters that came into Kristen's life and somehow led her to board a yacht, which disappeared. I can't say sank because we don't know, but the boat disappeared and Kristen disappeared. And I'll get into the story of how those people crossed her paths, why she might have been on the boat. And then Teresa and I are going to discuss some theories, because there are endless possibilities of what could have happened to Kristen, but kind of a handful of, I guess, starting point ideas that maybe make the most sense, but there's not enough evidence for anything to really be confirmed. So I'm looking forward to telling the story. I'm looking forward to everyone hearing it. We're also going to be on AM Extra on Coin with Teresa. She's going to be discussing the book, and it'll be right at the anniversary, the 44th anniversary, which is coming up this November.
That's our local CBS affiliate.
Yes, thank you. I look forward to that because
there aren't enough answers.
There just aren't enough answers, and there is so much to this story. I cannot believe it's not up there with Diane Downs and Kyron Horman and these really well-known cases, because it's just so fascinating. And what's really interesting talking with Teresa and reading the book and just researching the story is you can see why it doesn't have that coverage, because there were so many other criminal elements that we'll get into, a lot of fraud and insurance scams.
And a lot of purposeful obstacles, right?
Yes, yeah. Yes. And so all these other things of, we got to figure out who this person is or what alias is connected to that. And all of that took precedence over Kristen, and she kind of just fell through the cracks. So
hopefully shining a little bit of light on this will help with interest in the case more.
That is the goal, and that
more
is
coverage.
That is why Teresa wrote the book. Again, it's called Kristen, Can You Hear Me? It's even for me, this is me talking, and you know, y'all know who I am with books. I read it, I think, in 2 days. It's super informative. Teresa and Rhonda are in the book, but under different names. And you learn about their backgrounds a little bit and their relationship with Kristen. And then it goes into all the theories. It explains, obviously, way more detail than everything I got into with the teacher and all those elements. So it's important to support people that are getting these stories out. So Kristen, Can You Hear Me? It's available at Books A Million and bookshop.org and Thrift Books. And it's a great, great read. So pick up a copy so you have the story and you can hand it off to people and say, have you heard of this case? Because it is wild. And we'll be back with our next episode with the conclusion, but unfortunately no answers.
Hold on.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
My sleeves. It's too hot. It's too hot for my sleeves.
Over the next two episodes. Oh my God.
I need a waiter with some water.
Over the next.
Wolverine from the X-Men. Sorry.
What you doing over there? Playing with your chain wallet?
In my sleeping bag? Playing with my chain wallet, of course. Zoot suit riot.
I have youthful confusion.
I saw your dad's feet last night. I was not a fan.
Well, he's where I get my barefoot habit from. He's the king of barefoot. He's a California boy.
SoCal surfer dude.
Paid for her to get a... It's out of town. He invited... Very formal. Oh,
very Irish. It's the clowning capital in Nevada.
But her life there was an enviable... Damn.
And his nutsack lips.